All right, well, let's go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome you guys all to our colloquia. I want to do a quick survey, quick review for those of you who've been with us since the beginning, because I know that a lot of you actually have. We've been really focusing on the crafting of research paper. At the very beginning of the semester, Dr. Cowan talked to us about research as a process of discovery, of discovering truth, and discovering the truth things that you want to say right about your own work. Dr. Roper spoke to us about what exactly it is that academics do when they write articles and books, right? This kind of this weird and strange process by which we come up with arguments and ideas. We had Mr. Kirk from the library who came in and spoke to us about the actual process of research in the library, online, the sources that you want to find, the number of sources, right? How exactly do you go about kind of tackling research? Dr. Waterman Ward talked to us about bibliographies, why they're important, what kind of information we should put in a bibliography. And then last week, Dr. Kreider spoke to us about, okay, so once you actually have gathered your research, what do you do with it? How do you actually specifically and practically use it in your own writing, right? And he gave us different methods, different techniques, different formulas for incorporating that into your writing. So today, Mr. Brummett will be speaking to us about diction, and about balancing your diction with the critic's diction and the diction of the text, right, of the primary work that you're writing on. Right? How do you juggle and manage all of these different terms? So I'd just like to welcome Mr. Brummett here. He is actually an adjunct at the university. He works in the writing lab as well.
Thank you.
Is your question?
You said balancing our diction with critics and who else's?
The text itself, so the primary text.
Yeah, and as Ms. Niebuhr mentioned, that's kind of the goal of where I'll get to lead up to that. I'd like to talk about a lot of things related to diction, a lot of different aspects of diction, and just even what diction is, right, to begin with. Before I get into this discussion, though, I should warn you that I'm coming sort of more or less straight from the hospital, because my wife just gave birth to our first child. So most of you already know this, I think, because I know what to do. Thank you. So I'm going to go back to the hospital and pick them up and take them home. I really wanted to talk about diction. I think it's interesting. And I didn't want y'all to not have anything to come to for this writing colloquium. So that means, though, that I did not have as much time to finish my preparation for today. So I have an outline, and I have some typed notes and things. It's incomplete at best at this point, but that should be fine. And because of that, and in any event, I like being interactive. Ask questions throughout. We can afford some little tangents here and there about diction, about the essays you're working on, and so on and so forth. So we'll start sort of broadly talking about diction and then move ever more toward trying to think about balancing different, picking words based on a balance of the words you see in other materials that you're drawing upon. So to begin with, it's probably a good idea just to define my own terms, and my goal was to sort of model for you how you might even go about writing an essay in the sense of defining terms and progressing through an argument. Again, since this isn't even, I didn't have an opportunity to completely refine my own thoughts, that's probably not going to come through. But the title that I had given to this talk was Diction as Argument, How to Make Your Words Make Your Point. So there are a couple main words here that we've got to make sure we understand. Diction and argument, right? So I'm hoping that you all know that diction is, put simply, word choice, or your choice of words, right? Think dictionary, right? So when you're writing an essay, there are a lot of different ways you can express a particular idea. How you do that has to do with your diction, okay? And of course, as you surely all know, in a lit trad paper, for sure, any academic paper, really, you're going to need to have an argument. And just to be clear on what an argument is, I'm going to borrow a definition by a guy named Anthony Weston. Some of you who may have done Seven Arts might know this definition already. And he says an argument is a set of reasons or evidence in support of a conclusion. A set of reasons or evidence in support of a conclusion. So what I'm suggesting is that the very words you choose, your diction, leads you into an argument, right? A conclusion. That picking what might seem like a minor word even might have something to do with the reasons or evidence you're going to provide that leads your audience, your readers, to that ultimate conclusion that you want to make about whatever essay it is that you're writing. Now, step back a second and I'll just explain kind of where I got this idea of diction as argument. Originally, the idea was diction as storytelling. And this came out talking with some Seven Arts students last semester. And we were talking about etymology. So etymology, put simply, is the origin or origins and history of a word and its usage. So many words in the English language come from other languages, in fact. Latin and Greek in particular, oftentimes through French, right? So by the time an English word comes to us, it oftentimes has a lot behind it. It has a story of its own, a history and a story. So the particular words we were talking about in this conversation I was having with students last semester were words of from Greek and Roman history, mythology, words like Herculean, right? That's an adjective in English, meaning something like an impossible task, a Herculean task. So Herculean is roughly equivalent with impossible. But it's a very different word, right? If you're gonna say something's Herculean versus something's impossible or difficult. Because Herculean recalls to mind this story of Hercules, right? And so there's this whole story, this whole myth behind that word. So when you use that word, you're hoping your audience, your reader, remembers that story and thinks about Hercules when he or she sees Herculean, right? You could use a number of other words, but you chose that one. And hopefully you choose that one for a reason, and not just because it sounds good, and not just because a thesaurus tells you that it roughly works with a word you've already used and don't want to use again, or something like that, right? And if you realize that it's really clear in a word like Herculean that there's an origin and history of this word, but all words have that history behind them. They might not have a myth behind them, but they have a story, right? And that's what an etymology is about. And the more you know your etymologies, the more you'll be able to choose your diction wisely, or have good diction, to choose your words wisely. Most of you, I'm assuming, are in the midst of reading Milton right now in Litera 2. If not, you've probably already read some Milton. He really knows his classics. He knows his Greek and his Latin, right? So when he's using English words that come from Greek and Latin, he's very aware of their etymologies. He's thinking about how someone is going to understand this English word in light of the Latin word that it comes from, right? Now, no one in this room is anywhere near the classicist that Milton was, but if you know even just a little bit about Greek and Latin words, that might help you even understand some of these English words, right? And, well, what happens if you don't know Greek or Latin? What you can do, one thing you can do, is use the OED. Anybody know what the OED is? This is the Oxford English Dictionary. It's kind of overwhelming if you don't know something about etymology or words, histories, but it can tell you basically anything you want to know about a word, how it's been used at different times. So if you're writing about Milton, for instance, and you have a word that Milton uses, and you're interested in that word, if you look it up in the OED, you can find when it was used in the 16th and 17th centuries and how it was used, so that you can see how Milton would have likely heard that word used around him or read it in people who were roughly his contemporaries. Right? That can be useful. So that's one resource that you can use to help you think about etymology and the stories that are behind words. And then from there, like I said, ultimately I hope to get to talking about, and we can maybe even converse a little bit about, diction as argument, and that's bringing together different words that people have used in different contexts, such as Ms. Niebuhr pointed out already, the author uses certain words, other critics commenting upon that author use certain words, and then you have your own words, and how do you make all those fit together? That's where we're wanting to head. One thing that must be said about diction to begin with is that it has to be accurate, clear, precise, and concise as well. So just general advice about choosing words. If you can use one instead of four, use the one, right? Be short and to the point if you can. Usually using one word instead of four is actually not only going to be shorter, more concise, it's also going to be more precise as well, because that probably means it's a bigger word or a more exact word, and that just means that actually, provided that you're using the word correctly and the rest of the sentence makes sense, it's going to be clearer. Having fewer words in a sentence makes the sentence easier to understand oftentimes than having more words in the sentence, if you can say the same idea more succinctly. And of course, you need to use your words accurately. You need to make sure that you are using the word as it is in fact meant to be used. One way that UD students have of making sure that they are doing that is this little English handbook that you all are supposed to have for Litrad. It has a glossary of usage in the back. So it talks about the difference between words like accept, A-C-C-E-P-T, and except, E-X-C-E-P-T, right? Two very different words, meaning very different things. And if you think you're saying one and you accidentally type the other, your reader's going to be confused, right? There are multiple pages of these sorts of words in the back of the little English handbook, so it might be a good idea to flip through that at some point and just know which words are there, and maybe make a note to yourself of those words. And of course, the difficulty there is when you're doing your own editing, you might not realize. So that's also why it's a good idea, of course, use the writing center, or have a friend look over your essay and see if there's any if there are parts that are unclear in the words that you've chosen. Now I want to talk about another aspect of diction that's really important. And so I'm going to talk for a few minutes about key terms, or just terms in general. My razor's not working very well. Again, some of you will have learned this either in a 7 arts class or maybe in other literature courses already, maybe professors where I talked to you about the fallacy of equivocation. This is a good idea, good concept to keep in mind when you're writing. And basically, the fallacy of equivocation, well, I'll just go ahead and cite Weston here. I already cited his definition of argument. I'll cite his definition of equivocation. He calls the fallacy of equivocation, or defines it as sliding from one meaning of a term to another in the middle of an argument. So sliding from one meaning of a term to another in the middle of an argument. That's also useful to know what a term is. So a term is a particular word in your argument. Usually it's a key word, or we'll talk about key terms, right? An important word in your argument is a term. And if that term changes its meaning at some point, you have not been choosing your words wisely. You've not been wise with your diction. Let me try to provide an example of this. So the example that I had thought about when I was preparing for this is the word freedom. Two big ways that this word is used. One's positive, one's negative. Negative meaning freedom from something, like a prison, right? So you might say that a former prisoner of war is now free. This kind of freedom is negative in that it takes something away, those prison walls, right? Positive freedom, on the other hand, is the freedom to do something, right? To make a certain decision or to take a certain action. Right? So we use this word when we say something to the effect that, like, a car increases one's freedom. Right? So when you get sick, when you turn 16 and you get your driver's license, you suddenly have freedom. What we mean by that is you have the ability to go places now that you did not have before. You have this positive thing. So when you're using a word like freedom that can have both this positive and negative connotation, you need to be clear which word you're using, right? Because you can't go from talking about a positive idea of freedom to talking about a negative idea of freedom in the same argument and it still be correct and logically true and coherent. So the way that you avoid this fallacy of equivocation is by defining your terms, right? So early on, you need to let people know what you're talking about. When I say freedom, I mean this, right? That's important because it also probably will tell your audience something about how you understand what you're reading. Because if you're talking about free will, in Paradise Lost, for instance, and you say, this is how I understand free will, that's probably going to tell me something as a reader about what you think about Milton's argument. Or then you need to distinguish what you think Milton means by free will, right? Because if Milton's using the idea in one way, and some critic is talking about free will in another way, and seems to be misunderstanding Milton, you might need to say, I think this critic uses this word in a different way, or uses this idea in a different way than Milton does. And then you're having to juggle these different ideas together. Because what you'll often find is that similar words, oftentimes very simple words, can have very different meanings depending on how they're used, who's using them, right? So you need to know for yourself what the author is saying with when he or she uses a word, what critics mean by a certain word, and then what you yourself mean by that word. And when you're clear on all of those things, it'll be clear to your audience as well. Similarly, I think that it's not a good idea to use, even unreasonable, illogical, to use two different terms to refer to the same idea. Right? So technically the fallacy of equivocation is using one word to mean two things. I'm saying that it's also using two words to mean one thing, especially when it's a key term. Right? So a good example of this comes when you're talking about Achilles or Achilles, depending on how you want to say his name, in Homer's Iliad, right? You're probably going to be talking about anger, because that's kind of the point that we begin with, at least, in the poem, right? But if you start talking about anger on page one, and then by page two you're kind of tired of the word anger and want to talk about wrath, and then later on you decide to start using the word rage, that might confuse your audience. And you shouldn't go, like I said earlier, to a thesaurus to find a synonym for the word anger, because then you all of a sudden have five different words for anger, and you're using all of them indiscriminately all over your essay, and your reader doesn't really know what you're talking about anymore. So even though it might be repetitive to use anger throughout, in this case, I think it's better to do that and just use anger as much as you want than to try finding different words to plug in. Because if you say anger at one point and then you say wrath at some point, I'm going to be thinking, is this a stronger instance now? Is this a different kind of anger now? And you're just thinking that you're using a better word or a different word because you're getting bored of using anger. But your reader might be thinking you're saying something different, that you're actually making a point, right? So that's why I'm suggesting that your diction actually makes an argument. If you move from a discussion of anger to a discussion of wrath, you've just implied that there's a difference in two different situations when there might not be, even in your own understanding of it. So unless you want your audience to think that your understanding of one instance of anger and another instance of anger are different, you should not use different words. But if you do think Achilleus here, Achilleus there, different kinds of things happening, maybe then it's a good idea to move from anger to wrath. But when you do so, you have to explain. Here, Achilleus is just angry. Here, he's wrathful. And the difference is this. That's pretty interesting now. And you can see that then your very word choice is making an argument, right? To hint at, again, where this is ultimately going, you're sitting down with a critic, some translation maybe of a text. So for instance, if you're writing about Dante, you have to be writing about a translation. Even if you know Italian, you very likely don't know Dante's Italian. And even if you do, you're not going to be able to write an essay in it. So you're going to have to be dealing with a translation when you're talking about Dante for Lit Trad 2. That's going to be interesting because different translators are going to use different words, English words, to get Dante's ideas across. And then different critics might be using different translations. And so you might find that in 5 articles on Dante, the very same Italian word might be discussed in 5 different ways. So when you sit down to write your essay, it's going to be a good idea to think about which word are you going to use. Are you going to go with the word that your translator uses? Or are you going to go with the word that a particular critic uses? Or are you going to use a word that you like and then just explain somewhere? You could use a footnote, you could put things in parentheses. All of these words are used for this word, but I'm going to use this word. It might be helpful to just tell your audience, to tell your readers right then and there how you're using that word. Questions at this point? Okay, another thing to point out about diction, and then we can, actually maybe 2 more things to point out about diction more generally, and then move into maybe some time to discuss particularly how to deal with this issue of bringing a primary text and secondary texts together as you're writing your own essay. The difference between denotation and connotation. Are these things, are these words that make sense to people? Are these words you've heard before? Yes, no. Who's heard of denotation and connotation? Okay, good. You can learn something, hopefully. Here. So denotation means what the word actually, or refers to what the word actually means. You look up a word in the dictionary, that's its denotation. Right. Connotation, I think I misspelled connotation on the board. Yes, 2 N's, not 1. Connotation implies what the word connotes, what it brings out, what it elicits, what it makes you think and feel, right? So if you look up the words odor and aroma, for instance, in a dictionary, they both just mean smell. And yet, you don't talk about the odor of chocolate chip cookies and the aroma of the trash can, unless you're being ironic, right? Unless you're making some sort of a joke, usually. You could, but we don't. They both mean smell, but the word odor, somehow, over time, has come to connote bad smells. And aroma, over time, has come to connote good smells, right? There are a lot of words like this. Again, it goes back to knowing a word's etymology sometimes. It also just goes back to knowing how words are used. How you know what different words will connote, what kind of feelings they'll draw up. What do you think? How do you know that? Any suggestions of how you know that?
Practical experience.
Practical experience, that's a good way of putting it. What you mean by that, of course, is having read some books, having had conversations with people, right? Everyday life, over time, you start to realize when people use the word odor, they're talking about bad things. When they use the word aroma, they're talking about good things, right? Other words, similar situations, right? And so you want to use the word that connotes the right things, right? Not only does it mean the right thing, but you want the audience to have the right emotional reaction to it, or logical connections, right? And one last point about diction, generally speaking, and this gets even closer to this issue of bringing the poem, we'll say, into conversation with the articles that you'll, or books you'll be reading about the poem, and that's technical terms versus common language, right? So what are some technical terms that you might have seen this semester? Is everybody in here in Lit Trad 2, or is anybody not in Lit Trad 2?
In Lit Trad 2.
Who is not in Lit Trad 2? Okay. So most of you are in Lit Trad 2. If you are not in Lit Trad 2 right now, think about when you were in Lit Trad 2. And for the other of you, think about how this would apply in another class, perhaps. But for those of you who are in Lit Trad 2, what are some technical terms you've seen in Lit Trad 2? What do you think? Do y'all know what a technical term is? What do I mean by that?
Yeah, I was going to ask what you meant by technical.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. A technical term is a term, right? A term has to do with a special kind of word, as it's been earlier, right? So a technical term is, put rather bluntly, a term, a word that's being used in a technical way, a very specific way, right? So when we talk about a line of poetry, in some sense that's a technical term, because we don't mean like a line in the same sense that we do when we're talking about geometry or something like that, right? The word refers to different things there. Oftentimes the technical terms are rather complicated. They're rather long. They're rather specific. In English literature, oftentimes they're actually from Greek or from Latin, right? So what's maybe a foreign-sounding word to you that you've seen in Lit Trad 2, and it seems to have direct application to one of the texts you've been reading?
Contrapasso.
Contrapasso is a perfect example of a technical term in Lit Trad 2. And what does that word mean? Who can tell me what contrapasso means?
I can't remember the exact definition, but it's an ironic twist on the way it was used in Dante's Inferno. Contrapasso was meant to be a punishment that was ironic and specifically meant for the souls in hell. I can't remember.
Yeah, so it's sort of like an inversion.
Yes, yes.
Or it karmic in some ways, you might say. Right, so the contrapasso is a situation in which someone is punished in such a way as to fit the crime, the vice, the sin that this person committed in life, right? And then if similarly you see this in purgatory, although it's used to purge then. You purge sins by being forced to do things that you wouldn't have done in life, right? You're forced to go in a different direction than you would have gone in life. Something like this, right? Now, in this case, we're using an Italian term that Dante himself uses on occasion. And then oftentimes, though, we're applying it other places. I can't remember exactly how many times he actually uses it. I think it's only really in one instance that he uses this term. But then scholars will take that term and apply it to other instances, which, by the way, gives you the license to do that yourself, right? Once somebody else has done something, you can give that a try. You know, Dante uses the word in this canto, somebody else picks up the idea and talks about it in another canto, well then you could talk about it in yet another canto, right? And extend on that idea and see if you can push that idea further, right? But what happens if somebody's talking about contrapasso in one article and somebody else is talking about something like divine justice? Does that necessarily mean the same thing? Or, you know, I see some shaking heads. No. Maybe, maybe not, right? You'll have to see. It might be that when somebody uses the word contrapasso, they just mean something like divine justice or, you know, a punishment that fits the crime. Somebody might be using it very, very broadly. Somebody else might be using it very specifically. So if you see that word contrapasso in a couple different articles, see how that scholar's using that word. If you're going to use that word, make sure you know how you're using that word. It's a good idea to look and see if you can how it's used in Dante in that instance, where it's used in Dante, right? And to develop your own idea of that word out of those things. Other words that you might have seen that would be technical terms? Contrapasso is an easy example because it's a foreign word. Something that's not so foreign that's just as technical would be something like free will, which I already mentioned. On the one hand, it sounds really common, but when we talk about the idea of free will, we're actually talking about a theological, philosophical concept that's used in a very specific way. And it doesn't just mean, most of the time, that you're free to do whatever you darn well please, which is what some people think free will means, right? But in philosophical contexts, in theological context, it oftentimes is more limited than that, right? So a technical term is oftentimes a limited way of using a term. It's a very precise way of using a term in a specific context. And if you're not aware that a critic is using a word in a technical fashion, that can be a problem, because you might think, so for instance, justice, right? Sometimes justice we use fairly loosely, but in Phil and F, it becomes a very specific term that's really important when you're talking about Plato's Republic, right? And you might even think of it as a more technical term or something. It has a specific meaning there, and actually takes on lots of different meanings throughout that word, throughout that dialogue. And you need to be aware of how you're using that word. What do you mean when you say justice, right? That becomes a really important discussion. And you need to realize when different critics, when different scholars are talking about words like this, they might seem like really common words, but a particular critic might be using it in a very specific way to mean a very specific thing. So try to pick up on that. Other words that might have stuck out to you as a potential technical term? Yes?
Would saying like rings from Dante's Inferno, would that be a technical term?
Yeah, that's a good point. Rings, terraces, spheres, right? So a sphere in and of itself could just be a ball, right? A basketball could be called a sphere, but that's definitely not what we're talking about when we're talking about spheres in Paradiso, right? And a ring, clearly, you know, some people wear rings on their fingers, some people wear rings in their ears, all sorts of things like that. That's very different than the rings of hell, right? A terrace oftentimes just refers to a garden or something. That's very different than in Purgatorio when they're on a mountain, right? And so when you're talking about a terrace, yeah, you're talking about it, you're using that in a technical term, in a technical sense, when you're talking about it in Dante, right? And I would advise you when you're reading scholars, and then also when you're seeing things on a syllabus, or when your professor is using certain terms in class, to pick up on what kind of technical terms are being used. Because if you don't realize really early on in a discussion of Dante what a ring is, right, that's going to be a problem. If you're thinking about a different kind of ring than the rings of Inferno, you're going to be confused, right, very quickly. So you don't want to talk about, well, some people would say circles too, right? So you might see somebody say the rings, this ring of Inferno, or you might see somebody say this circle of Inferno, right? That's an example of where you're going to have to choose one, right? You pick one and use that consistently. You can do what your professor has called, has used. You can do what your translator has used. You can use what a particular scholar has used. But you might need to realize that some scholars would be using different terms again, right? And bringing those together in your own work. Yes?
Why would it matter if they both mean the same thing, right?
Yeah, they both mean the same thing. The problem is, again, if you are talking about one critic on page 2 of your essay and you're talking about circles, and then on page 5 of your essay you start talking about rings, it potentially could confuse your reader. Now, if your reader knows Dante and knows that both of these things are talked about commonly as meaning the same thing, it might not be a problem. But if, I don't know, you have a sibling that wants to read this paper, that sibling might not understand that the same rings and circles mean the same thing. So you, when you use that word, you probably want to use the same word every time. And if you have to quote someone who's using a different word to mean the same thing, that's okay. And if you feel necessary, you can explain. If it's a situation where you might not recognize pretty easily that they're the same thing, it might merit a footnote or something like that. I'm just suggesting that you be consistent in your own use of terms, and that you realize that sometimes the terms that scholars are going to be using are not consistent.
So when you use certain diction, what Andrew says that you should use a lot of synonyms because you could change the terms, where's the line between being too repetitive?
Exactly. So that's actually something that I had written out some thoughts about. Let me refer to them to see what I was thinking. So I was thinking about the difference between repeat, repetition, and redundancy, right? And you'll notice that, again, I'm using a lot of etymology here. I'm thinking about what terms mean, what the stories are behind words, to help me understand and to explain to you how these things work, right? So the word repeat comes to English from the Latin word repetere. Repetere? I'm not actually sure what the accent is on that one, if it's a third or fourth declension. I mean, conjugation. But it means to return to. Right, it just means to return to. So it's okay to repeat, I would say, key terms. Return to your key terms. over and over and over again, because that's what your essay's about, right? But it becomes redundant, which comes from a Latin word meaning overflowing, right? So redundant means like, think waves crashing against an ocean, crashing against a shore from the ocean over and over and over again. Because und there in that redundant means wave, right? And the re means again. So redundant is over and over and over again, these waves hitting the shore, hitting the beach, right? And if you've ever been on a beach being smacked by wave after wave after wave, it's the same thing over and over and over again, right? That's like drowning your audience then. Being redundant is like trying to drown your audience using this term over and over and over again, unnecessarily. So I would suggest that key terms be very consistent and very precise and explain when you're using them and why you're using them. If it's not a key term, if it's not really important to your argument, by all means use synonyms. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions about technical terms or bringing authors to terms, different critics? So the main thing that I'm suggesting to you then about how to make, well, maybe a slightly new point actually. If your diction is an argument, you need to realize that some scholars, like there are actually different camps of scholars, right? I think it was Dr. Kreider who was talking about this, that there are different ways of categorizing the spectrum of critical opinion, right? There's camp A and camp B, camp C, what have you, right? You might start realizing if you do that kind of work that camp A uses this term and camp B uses this term. And if you use term B, you're in camp B, or it might look like it. And if you're using term B and you're actually in camp A, that's going to be kind of confusing to your reader, because some other reader who knows what that critical conversation looks like might be confused. I don't have any hard examples of what that might mean, but for instance, well, maybe something like love for how you understand the Commedia, right? Some people think of love as very broadly in Dante, right? Any kind of love they think is great. But for Dante, others would say love is a very specific thing and it has to be directed in good directions, right? Yes, Dante agrees that love is sort of the same thing all the time, but he suggests that if it's pointed in a bad direction, it can be very vicious, and if it's pointed in a good direction, it's very virtuous, right? But some people seem to think that every time, every instance of love is a good thing, right? So, for instance, Paolo Francesco, right? Is this a good situation or not, right? What do you do with Dante's reaction to that situation? Oh, well, you know, this is a love story, right? Well, what kind of love is it, right? Some people think that this is a good thing. Other people say it's a bad thing. Some people could try to make a more middle ground approach, right? But when you're talking about ideas and themes that maybe seem very simple, like love, it seems like a simple thing. We talk about it all the time. But particularly when you're talking about Dante, and all of a sudden you get to the end of the poem and there's this the love that moves the sun and other stars, you realize that love is a key term. It's a very key term. It's central to understanding Dante. So you've got to be very careful with how you use what's actually a very simple term, because it's actually become, in Dante's scholarship, in Dante, it's a technical term, right? It's got to be used in specific ways, at least in certain places, right? Because by the end of the poem, the love that's moving the sun and other stars, it's not just any love, it's divine love, right? And that's pretty important. So you might actually need to say at some point something about divine love to make it clear what you mean. And that you might see some scholars not being as clear because they don't see as much of a difference between, say, human love and divine love. But if you want to distinguish between the two, you'll need to make sure you say human love and divine love. Does that make sense? So the main thing that I'm suggesting to you is be as clear as you possibly can with every single thing you say, because even the simplest of terms could lead your audience astray in misunderstanding your argument if you're not careful with how you present that term, how you phrase something, and being aware that there are ways these words are commonly used. So even if you haven't talked about a particular canto or something, or maybe a particular episode, a scene in Paradise Lost or something, even if you haven't talked about that in class, if you start doing some research on it, you'll see that particular scholars, or that maybe even all the scholars, are talking about a particular idea. They're using a particular term. An example that I can use that won't help any of you at the moment, is it's called concatenation. And it's linking together. And my favorite poem, Pearl, does this. All the stanzas are linked together. And if you go and you look at articles about Pearl, you'll see this word concatenation showing up. And if you don't know what that is, you need to go look it up. And then you find out what it is, and you use that word, because that shows that you've done some research, you know who you are. It establishes ethos, if nothing else. You know what ethos is? Your credibility, right? Similarly, if your professor's using certain terms a lot in class, look those terms up. Think about what those terms mean. Try to use those terms, even if you end up defining them differently than your professor does. Make sure you indicate in your essay that you have a different understanding of that term. But if there's certain words that come up over and over and over again in class, you need to know how to use those terms and how they're used when talking about the particular author that you're writing your essay over. Right? Because, for instance, love could be talked about very differently in Dante versus in Milton. Right? You could have very different understandings, perhaps. We've got different cultures, different time periods. So even though Dante and Milton are taking up the same idea, they very oftentimes are thinking about it in slightly different ways, or maybe very different ways, depending on what the idea is, right? Potentially, Dante and Milton's views of femininity could be very different. It depends on how you read Milton, right? It's very clear what Dante thinks about femininity and women. Milton, it's a little more difficult, right? But if you want to talk about femininity in Dante and Milton, you're going to have to bring together different, perhaps different uses of this idea. They're not necessarily using the same terms because, of course, they're writing in different languages. But the scholars writing about them very well would be using the same terms, but might be thinking about them in different ways. And so you need to then bring those together. So particularly if you're having a paper that deals with both Dante and Milton, you're going to have very different kinds of scholarship, and you might see the same word or the same term used in different ways. So then when you sit down to write your essay, you're going to either have to make it very clear to your reader that in talking about Dante, this word means something different than when you're talking about Milton, or you're going to have to use the word consistently throughout and show that you vary your usage somewhat from maybe somehow the other scholars do. Time's up for what's allotted for the colloquium today. I can still answer other questions if you have other questions, but if you have somewhere else to go, by all means, go there.